Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and doing his best Brad Pitt impression, or sorry, his best impression of Taron Killam impersonating Brad Pitt is James. Before we get started, check out our previous podcasts. We most recently talked about The Exorcist. Before that, we talked about Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Bonnie and Clyde, Sicario, three-part podcast about Seinfeld, and earlier this week, we put out a video podcast about the movie that we will be discussing today. So if you want to see a more visual representation of some of the ideas we're talking about today, you can check that out. So themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen and tell your friends about us. Post this episode on Facebook, maybe. Could help us out. Post it on Twitter. Post it on Instagram. We don't have a big Instagram presence, so you can do that. All right, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
Let's turn the Jack White shredding down a little bit. Get to talk about this movie.
Yet still be hard to understand.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're talking about The Social Network.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as you said, we have a video out too. And I believe part of your affection for this movie is all the fun visual things that go on and kind of how well put together this movie is. So yes, check out the video for some more specific stuff on that.
Yeah. Even just as an excuse to watch David Fincher visuals, like just do it. Don't be an idiot. Like all the clips are from the first 20 minutes of the movie, which is some of the most perfect filmmaking you'll ever see in your life. So go check that out.
Yeah, the intro scene to this one, I think, is one of the kind of more well-known, maybe not quite iconic, but, you know, particular to this film, the intro scene is very important, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why is that the case? So you seem very confident of that.
Well, Fincher and Sorkin have both sort of talked about how they, I mean, this movie's directed by David Fincher. I don't think we've mentioned it's written by Aaron Sorkin, but everybody fucking knows that. Anyway.
I like how you spoke really quickly as you said that.
yeah, exactly. Like, this is all information everybody should already know. Just like every Sorkin character thinks about everything. Anyway, so they've both talked about how they felt that the first scene of the movie really wanted to set the tone for the rest of the film.
Yeah, and I heard Fincher say, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but he wanted to show the audience how to watch the rest of the movie from that scene. Mm-hmm. So continue, please.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically it. And I mean, you know, there's a Sorkin feel to Sorkin dialogue that exists in pretty much everything that he writes. And it's so different from everything else that you kind of have to get used to it initially. And one of the things I love about David Fincher's approach to doing that is that he expects people to catch up. He'll just throw you into it and you just have to deal with it. And I think we get the Sorkin dialogue before we even escape the black screen, you know, after the Columbia and Sony logo or whatever. And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful scene. There's like five conversations happening at once between two people. it's very funny and it's so well performed and it's so well shot. And like it's for Fincher, it's a very laid back sort of style of shooting throughout this whole movie. Fincher really has reined himself in. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous movie, but you know, there's none of that like really stylish stuff that you get pretty much from Panic Room and previous in his career. Zodiac, he sort of starts to slow down, and The Social Network is very much post Zodiac Fincher. But it's still like really, really well done. Like there are two close-ups in the scene, both of Erica right at the beginning when she mentions final clubs for the first time. I think when she's still calling them finals clubs. And then at the very end of the scene when she calls Mark an asshole. And the reason that those are the two close-ups in the scene are because those are the two important points. And Fincher really likes to use close-ups sparingly. Jesse Eisenberg has talked about actually how Fincher explained this method to him on set of why they were only shooting two lines in you know, full-on close-up and why neither of them were Mark. And it was because like you have to use them sparingly because, you know, whether consciously or unconsciously the audience takes this in, they see these as the important moments of the scene. And And you can see this all throughout Fincher's career. I mean, he's a brilliant man. But yeah, that's the important part of the scene, and the asshole line specifically, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, so I guess so when he says this is kind of showing you the way to watch the rest of the movie, you touched on it a bit, but you think it's, you know, just paying close attention being one of them. Like, it's, you know, they do speak very quickly, and they're also just in a loud bar with loud music playing and a lot of people around them. Like, it's just, there is a lot of, you know, not only is the dialogue, you know, very quick, like literally just being, you know, words per minute would be very high. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of, you know, jumping around from subjects, you know, they'll say something and, you know, two sentences will pass by and then someone will ask to clarify, you know, the previous sentence. And, you know, it really just hops around. Mm-hmm. And so it's that kind of stuff that you're saying, you know, you really just have to pay attention to, kind of keep everything that's just been said in the back of your mind in case it gets referenced again, but staying on top of the kind of witty things that are happening sentence by sentence too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Exactly. And it's pretty impressive that Erica can keep up given that she goes to BU.
Yeah. That might be our most used line from this movie.
I tend to say I'm devastated by that pretty frequently, but most people don't catch on that that's a reference.
Right. And actually, this was the first time I noticed watching this, and we get our first use of this line I'm about to say that does appear twice in the movie. In that first scene when he says, you know, if I get into the final clubs, I can introduce you to, you know, some important people that you won't meet because you go to BU. Mm-hmm. And she has a very sarcastic, you would do that for me. And, you know, Mark picks up on it right away. And, you know, it's she's kind of, you know, taking a dig about how arrogant he's being and how kind of condescending he's being because she doesn't go to Harvard. She only goes to Boston University. Mm-hmm. And then later on, when the Winklevi offer to, you know, kind of rehab his public image after the face mash thing, you know, and initially gets him suspended and kind of gets him into a lot of a negative attention, especially from the females on campus. Mark says that line to the Winklevoss. He says, you know, you would do that for me. Like you would help me rehab my image. Mm-hmm. I'd never noticed that until watching it this time. And I've seen this movie a few times.
Yeah.
I really like that one, and I really appreciate that it seems lost on the Winklevi too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the way that Mark picks up on it right away. And I mean, the Winklevoss twins aren't played for dumb jocks really in this movie. You know what I mean?
Like, no, not at all.
They're definitely jocks, but they're, you know, seem very, you know, intelligent and organized.
Rowing is generally viewed as one of the smarter type of jocks, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't seem, not that it seems like anything too complicated, but yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. And again, just one more thing about them in that intro scene, kind of hopping back and forth so much, that really is the structure of the movie we're going to see as well. It's not just the dialogue that we're going to run into for the next, you know, 2 hours, whatever it is. You probably know the exact running time. You're good at those.
It's like after end credits, it's like just over 2 hours, like seconds over.
Yeah. So not only is the dialogue for this whole movie kind of something we have to keep our eye on, but, you know, just the structure of this movie going two different depositions. And then we have the, you know, further in the past of Facebook actually being created.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think, I think it's clear we both like this movie. I think most people like this movie.
I think this movie is like a stone cold masterpiece. So, and I feel like that will become very clear throughout this podcast if it hasn't already.
Okay. I forgot what I was going to ask you. Okay, sorry. Go ahead if you have anything. I'll remember, I swear.
No, this movie's great. I love this movie so much. Yeah, okay. Just point to a part of it that you want me to talk about, and I'll talk about it for 20 minutes and why it's perfect.
Okay, well, after you know that intro scene we've discussed, we get Mark kind of moving around Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, he's just going back home, and he starts drinking and goes on his little blog rant about Erica.
Yeah, I kind of want to talk about the in between stuff that happens there.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get at too. So.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, we get the line that Erica says that kind of is her sort of knockout punch of that conversation is, you know, you're going to be probably a really successful computer person. and you're going to think people don't like you because of that or something.
Yeah, she says you're going to tell yourself people don't like you because you're a nerd, but really they're not going to like you because you're an asshole.
Exactly. And then she just takes off. And then that leads him to run, as you said, sort of jogging back to Kirkland, his residence. It's really interesting the way that sound is used in this movie. The sound really drops out there, and only there and only one other point in the movie that we will absolutely get to. But, you know, because everybody's talking all the time and there's so much good use of sound, both, you know, as sound effects and music, I think. But, you know, it's just sort of like this is something that really registers with him and something that he really focuses on. And the song that is playing, I think, is kind of interesting as well. The movie starts before, again, before we hear, see anybody, before we hear anybody, at the very beginning of the Columbia logo, we've got Ball and Biscuit by the White Stripes, right? Yep. And that's off of their album Elephant, which I believe came out in 2003 when the movie starts. If not, it came out in 2002. But it was an album that was popular enough, especially with college kids, that a bar could conceivably play a 7-minute song from it with extended guitar solos without backlash, right?
Yeah.
And it's also this very sort of classical style of rock music. And it was, you know, so classical that the liner notes in Elephant, I don't know if you're aware of this, if you had the record, but it says, in the liner notes, no computers were used during the writing, recording, mixing, or mastering of this record, right?
Yeah, so I remember that.
Okay, yeah. So that's, I mean, obviously it's a very Jack White thing to do. Yes. And, you know, he still sort of has this contradictory feelings towards technology, even though he uses Pro Tools for a lot of the time now. But, what Mark does as that song is fading out is he runs away from a place that would play this type of music. Like, he's running away from this sort of analog world and he's going to create part of the new digital world. And he's literally running from it. And I think it's really interesting that we get this sort of, as he's running, jogging home, it's very obviously a piano played. And it's a very, I think, a very beautiful theme and really works well for the movie. It feels sort of sad and lonely, not unlike Mark at the time. And it's called Hand Covers Bruise. And, you know, as he's jogging along, we have this traditional instrument. And then he goes and uses his fingers, which is how you play the piano, to make a very new, non-traditional sort of instrument for his computer to be used. And we don't hear
his finger on a keyboard.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't hear much music as the focus throughout the rest of the movie. I think it's the California song, and then anytime an actual song is used, it's pretty much in the background until the very end. And I think that's really, really interesting. And obviously the score for this movie is exceedingly electronic. And even when the piano does make its two further appearances throughout the movie, it, like, they literally record them from further away. The piano theme is used 3 times. First time it's used, recorded up close. Second time the mic is moved further away from the piano. Third time it's even further away from the piano in how they recorded it. And it sounds like that. And it's great. It's a great touch.
Yeah, I think watching it this time was the time I most appreciated the score for this movie.
Mm-hmm. It's really great. and it really flows as a part of the movie. Like, the thing that I find is so impressive about Fincher is that everybody is so good at their job. Like, the sound designer, the editors, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, the composers. But they're also good in a way that isn't necessarily showy. You know?
Yeah.
And it's always in service of the movie. And I think just because the collection of all these things often ends up being really showy, and there are certainly set pieces in this movie that are that, but there's always like a really strong connection to an idea that they're trying to get across. And it's really cool.
Yeah. And the regatta scene when the Winklevi are rowing competitively,
mm-hmm.
the only time we really see it in this movie, there's that in the Hall of the Mountain King.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember? But it's that, you know, it's a much, much different sounding, very electronic one. So even kind of these moments where they have, you know, they're going for this very traditional thing. It's, you know, they made it a very different one. They said Fincher told them to go for a Wendy Carlos version of it, who's an American composer who plays a lot of classical music, but electronic and, you know, kind of takes very popular kind of traditional music and makes it a lot different, a lot more modern sounding. Mm-hmm. And to your point, just kind of a good thematic use of that music is this is when the Facebook idea is getting away from the Winklevoss. This right after the race is when they're told that the school, the Facebook or FaceMash, whatever it is, I guess it's Facebook or the Facebook maybe at that point, mm-hmm. Has reached, you know, Oxford.
No, they've dropped the preposition by that point.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Just kidding. No, because someone really cool told them to.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's interesting that it's this classical song being played in this electronic version at that point of the movie because, as I said, this is when Facebook has already gotten away from the Winklevoss twins. It's right after this race that they find out that it's reached all these new schools and that, you know, this Zuckerberg's really kind of forcing them to do something if they want him to stop. You know, they've kind of tried to take the classy Harvard gentleman way out by not doing anything and talking to him and sending letters. But now, you know, you need an injunction. You need the court to be involved. You need police involved and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so it's just a really interesting time that song, it's before they even know it, but it's while that song is being played, it's gotten away from them and that they're this little world that they're used to, which is a theme I'm sure we'll talk about, is fading and kind of the big signifiers of it, like music and things like that. And even just what's being discussed at these parties is getting away from them and becoming something very digital as Facebook kind of creeps in. And even these kind of older, stodgy, you know, European royalty and aristocrats are saying the word Facebook. And now it really seems like, you know, this world that the Winklevoss looked like they were going to kind of rule or at least inhabit successfully for a while is getting away from them. And that's, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. Well, the camel's backs for them because there's two of them.
Yeah. And also that's really close to the last time we see the Winklevi in the movie. Like we see the actual race and then the aftermath of the brutally close race. And then that's pretty much it for them. As far as I can recall, that is it for them in the flashback scenes. And then we get sort of a wrap up deposition scene. And then the last 20 to 25 minutes of the movie is just really like the Winklevi just sort of and Divya really just sort of fall out of it because there's just nothing left for them. You know, they've lost. It's over.
They lose in so many ways right there. Like they lose the race by a little bit and then they find out that they've effectively, you know, kind of lost out on Facebook by this point. And then the movie kind of forgets about them. But it's, you know, it's this theme of a race being really played out. It's, well, you didn't make it first, so yeah, no one's gonna remember you. If you had invented Facebook, you would have invented Facebook.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I touched on it a bit there and I knew it had come up, but this movie is very explicitly about exclusivity. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite uses, they're all over the place, but one that I was really enjoying this time around was still at that Henley Royal Regatta. And you might be better at talking about this because of the visual nature of it, but that scene is shot in such a shallow focus, mm-hmm. that when anybody kind of moves a little bit, they get out of focus and they instantly become blurry. And this movie is so much about, you know, being in or being out, being part of a final club or not being part of a final mm-hmm. club, being, you know, one of the owners or inventors of Facebook or not being it. And as I kind of pointed to before, I mean, the regatta is that kind of just that world. It's a very small group of people, but a lot of power, and it's very wrapped up in tradition and what's proper and what can be done and, you know, dressing the right way and speaking the right way and all these kinds of things that, you know, it's just about playing by the rules. And when you deviate from that a little bit, you know, no one can see you. You're blurry again to the camera. Just even the fact that scene was shot with miniatures, just kind of speaking about how this is just one little small pocket in the world. And when you're inside it, it seems so big and so important and so grand. But there are so many other little pockets in the world, and something like Facebook and like the internet in general just brought all these kind of worlds together. And well, not together as though you can go from one to another very easily, but just that kind of comparing all of them and that there is this little world and there's all these rules that need to be played by, and you can easily be on the kind of excluded list from the included list very easily.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking to the whole shallow focus thing. That exists throughout the entire movie. If anybody knows anything about cameras, they shot this whole movie at aperture 1.3, which is insane. like, especially since, you know, like, I can't find anybody going out of focus that's supposed to be in focus for even half a second. Like, and that's so difficult. Like, I don't know how to explain it without having a camera in front of me, like, and showing people, but it's just so, it's so possibly difficult. And shout outs to the camera assistants on this movie and any Fincher movie, because that's very, very much part of his aesthetic. The regatta, especially. What they did was kind of they put lenses on these sort of tilts that sort of add like further blur out sections of the screen as well. And part of the reason they did that was apparently to, because they shot the actual regatta that was happening that that July 4th, and July 4th, 2010, that weekend. But they couldn't put Armie Hammer and Josh Pence in the middle of that. So they shot the inserts and stuff on. Not the Charles River, but somewhere, some sort of man-made lake around Boston. And they had to further blur everything out just so that they could cut it in. So it was partially practical and partially meaning, you know, because I think it really adds something, because one thing that's present throughout this movie is the winner is the person with the laser focus, the person that focuses on one thing, specifically Mark, who pretty much every time somebody takes a break in this movie, Mark is just staying there at the table or working. Like in the depositions, when people call lunch, he never gets up. You know, when Rashida Jones is carrying in, or Marilyn, I believe her name is carrying in her salad. He's just there on the computer, like he never left the room. We never see him leave a deposition room. And even when, you know, when Facebook gets to 1 million members, there's a part, like, you know, everybody's cheering, and we see Mark sitting at his desk, you know, by himself. And then the party that's going on, that Sean has to call him from jail, Mark was still in the office in that exact same chair. Like, it's crazy how little Mark does outside of, like, focusing on the goal that he has to accomplish, whether it's getting through these depositions or establishing Facebook. And the Winklevi focus on a lot more. They keep up with their studies. They mentioned their GPA being very impressive. I don't remember the number, but and they're rowing in this regatta, and they're trying to establish the Harvard connection, and that's too many things.
Yeah, and you get that kind of summed up really quickly when they talk about how busy they've been, and they list off kind of what their schedule for that day is, and I think Mark's schedule was one word, you know, where they have kind of, you know, they have to go on for a while just to list all the things they're going to cover in one day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So we kind of veered away from it, but that intro scene not the intro scene, but the one we were discussing when he goes back to his residence, that's when we get these shots that we get a lot of. It starts up there getting shots of walls, and, you know, just the idea that there's this exclusivity theme running throughout the movie. I think it's pretty clear why that could be meaningful, but we kind of see him walk up and down walls. But then we also get a lot of glass in this movie, and walls made of glass, and shots of people through walls. Do you have a read on that?
Well, the one that really jumps out to me is what I think is the last time that we see it, when Eduardo is just figuring out that he's been screwed over, and he turns around and looks at Mark, and the way we're seeing a POV shot from Eduardo's perspective, and Mark is far away from him, and he looks far away from him in the frame, and there is also that layer of glass, like he just doesn't understand who Mark is anymore, you know. That was the one that really jumped out at me, but I'm curious to know your take.
No, I mean that's similar to what I think. And yeah, I mean, in that case, we kind of have this, you know, you kind of touched on it, but this invisible barrier. We've always, it's just the friendship that Eduardo and Mark have. It seems really weird to me throughout so much of this movie, and I don't mean that it's just poorly performed or anything, but it's just an interesting relationship. But yeah, that the glass kind of coming between them, and just how distant of a shot that is. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's such a wide shot of just one single person being the only person we care about. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, kind of showing the distance between them, and then this invisible barrier, which I think at that point, Edward has realized that barrier has been there the whole time, and he hasn't really just been able to see it.
Yeah.
And then it's a little while after that, we get the shot of Eduardo's chicken in the cage. And,
yeah.
You know, that's just kind of a more, you know, it's these opaque metal bars. It's now you can see that people really are separated. And even though you've been able to see the person through glass, the bars are now apparent. The things that are making you separate and that are going to prevent you guys from being friends are just so clear now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think the chicken thing actually precedes it slightly, but it still makes perfect sense. Like in what you're saying, it's sort of like a lead in to these, you know, the lead in, you know, you can still get through bars. You can't get through that glass without opening the door. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing that I was amazed with glass in this movie for all the computer screens that we see and reflections of people in, you know, windows and glass walls like that, you never see anyone's face reflected in a computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty incredible. And I mean, similar to the regatta thing, there could be that technical explanation for it, but
yeah, I've got it for you right now if you want.
Yeah, no, I think I know exactly what it is, but it's the same thing. And I you know, maybe it's just luck and we're reading too much into it, or if it was conscious or something thought about and then you know, not really addressed because it was kind of working out well already. But just a movie that has so many people working on laptops and looking at screens, and even just movies that aren't so about computers or technology, you still usually get a shot like that because it can be interesting to do a shot like that. We don't really get anybody reflecting on a computer screen as though all these kind of identities that they're creating aren't accurate representations of who they really are.
Yeah, exactly. That makes perfect sense.
Free to take away all my fun with your technical.
No, that makes sense. The practical reason why you can't see that reflection is very simple. All of the computer screens are composites. Mm. Meaning that, you know, when on set, Jesse Eisenberg is looking at a laptop with a blue screen, and then they just superimpose what's supposed to be on that computer screen in post.
Yeah, like a blue screen background.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also like just notoriously difficult to shoot monitors with cameras. Like it's just something about the flicker that always messes things up. I'm sure that's gotten better with time, but you know, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Monitors and fluorescent lights. They're the worst. one thing I want to talk about with the exclusivity and walls element that you've discussed, the way that they shot that big, wide, high-angle shot of Mark running through the, I don't even know what we'd call it, but it's outside the border of Harvard during the title sequence.
The quad.
Is it the quad? I didn't know if that's...
I have no idea.
Yeah. That was going to be my guess.
It's a college word.
I still don't know what quads are, so...
It's usually just kind of like the center square or rectangle.
Okay.
Inside. It's like a courtyard of a campus, really. That's my understanding. There's co-eds and frisbees there. That's all I got.
So, yeah, the way that they shot that, actually, because Harvard did not let the filmmakers do pretty much anything on Harvard.
Do you know why?
I don't know. I don't know that I got a real reason.
They shot a movie there in 1970 called Love Story, and apparently significant amount of physical damage was done, and they've never let anyone shoot there again.
Gotcha. Yeah, okay. Anyway,
composite shots of Harvard.
Yeah, exactly. That shot is actually Harvard because the apparently those walls and the walk-ins to the campus are very, very iconic and familiar. But what they did was they found the one building that Harvard didn't own around there and rented out the rooftop and put three cameras there and sort of composited the shot between the three of them because they couldn't get like a motion rig up there easily. And Harvard didn't give them the permission to do that shot. So what they had is under one of these archways, they set up a mime, like they built him a big light and hired a mime who is not in the shot. Like he's totally blocked by things, and set up this light and had him mime. Thinking that if Harvard security was on anything first, it would be this mime with this giant light, and that would tip them off to what's going on, and then they'd be able to either finish the take quickly or just sort of shut down for a minute while they finish that. And I thought that was so funny.
That's very funny.
And also just in general, the fact that this movie at any point didn't have a permit for something is pretty funny at such a high level, you know, just because they couldn't get the permit.
Yeah.
So they're just like, fuck it, we need the shot. And I love that. I love that about Fincher. I love that about, you know, everything in this movie. It's just sort of like, you need the shot. Let's make it happen. You know?
Yeah, I know. That's cool. And I just, you know, to take a step back on that too, just this idea that Harvard isn't allowing these people in. You know, it's just, as you said, this was a big movie, you know, Fincher, Sorkin, or, you know, real studio, lots of big names involved. They still kind of were on the outside of Harvard and not allowed in, and just the exclusivity of Harvard continuing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And still on the idea of exclusivity, the idea of Eduardo writing the algorithm on that window the first time.
Yeah.
Why do you laugh?
No, it's just I was just thinking of the line, if you knew what you were looking for, you would have seen it on my dorm room window.
Yeah. I just find that one a particularly interesting use of this, you know, theme of walls, because it's this writing on the window. I mean, it can be seen from both sides, and it's literally on the wall. It's what's going to kind of bring down all these barriers is written on the barrier, you know what I mean? And this whole idea of, you know, Facebook starting out as being something so exclusive, but its value coming from just expanding and expanding and expanding. It's literally on this thing between these two worlds, you know, his private bedroom and the public, you know, just the campus. I think that's really interesting as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And then we get one more, I think, interesting use of that is when Mark is explaining to Eduardo his idea, and they're, you know, they're inside the party at the Jewish fraternity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's clearly not shot in a way to make it look like a glamorous, great party by any means. Yeah. And that's kind of the joke. But when Mark needs to explain his idea, he needs to take Eduardo outside. Like, this is such an essentially outsider's idea that we have to go outside and discuss this. Yeah. And, you know, they're outside this building. And then, of course, Eduardo goes back in through a door that says private entrance. Like, it's just another reminder that there are all these little pockets that you need to be invited into. And just what he's after is something that is so antithetical to that idea.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, we get that a lot with the Winklevi, for sure. The bike room of the Porcellian is as far as Mark is allowed in. As far as I know, it's also as far as Divya is allowed in, it looks like. But yeah, these elements of exclusivity exist all throughout the movie, you know?
Yeah, and I thought a really interesting play on that is a scene that, you know, we talk about in the video, but it's when all the women are being bussed into the party.
Yeah.
And that's, you
like,
know,
you know, on a bus, like on an, an automobile. They're not all just collectively kicking in doors.
No. Yeah, they're being brought into this party. And simultaneously, we have these shots of Mark kind of hacking into the houses to get all their pictures to make face mash. And, you know, we just get this juxtaposition of good looking girls being invited in and Mark being, you know, having to be so, you know, be a hacker and be Gladys Stein and, you know, do things this way outside of the law. But it's really the only way he can get into these things, even digitally, or make something digitally that makes him popular, or at least well known on campus.
Yeah, for sure. And those people at the frat party are doing more celebratory drinking, whereas Mark is rage drinking at not being at this party, you know.
Yeah,
or not, you know, specifically this party, but, you know, this party in general.
Capital P party.
Yeah,
big party.
Yeah. Jesse Eisenberg's nickname on set, oddly enough.
Big party. Yeah. Not the runes. I have a question for you.
Okay.
Who in this movie is the most like Mark Zuckerberg?
Sorry, I'm choking on some water here. I drank it too quickly, not unlike Jesse Eisenberg drinks every drink in this movie. Who's the most like Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah.
Like, character-wise?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. Douglas Urbanski's character, the dean of students.
Yeah, I think that's exactly who I think it is, Larry Summer.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know what you thought of that. I mean, he seems like, you know, he's the head of this old stodgy establishment, kind of what you would think would be so clearly the one side of this inside outside exclusivity theme we've been touching on a lot. What do you make of him being seemingly so opposite of, you know, everything else about his character?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's an interesting point. I think this whole movie is about Mark wanting something and then attaining something, and then at the end of the movie realizing, like, what did it cost? You're exactly right. Like, they are very similar characters, and at the end of the movie, Mark is very much a member of this sort of old world establishment. He's new money, but he's big money, you know, and he's big enough money that he has to spend his days, you know, in the middle of legal cases and stuff, because his company's big enough to require that. And you're exactly right that they're both assholes in similar ways. And they're both the heads of something. And what Mark did was start this company from the ground up, but it got to the point where it got big enough that it kind of has to be taken into this sort of old world rules. At some point you get swallowed up by what you want, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. It's just like, to me, just what was striking is, yeah, as you said, they're assholes in very similar ways. It's not just that they're both bad. Like, they talk about people like they aren't there. They, you know, kind of just, you know, he almost says to the Winklevoss twins, you know, just, you were slower if you had invented Facebook than you would be the inventor of Facebook. Like, it's, he's so kind of flippant about it. And, you know, he's kind of saying, like, you shouldn't have to make a case to me if this were true, which is so much of what Mark Zuckerberg's about, too. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're exactly right. And I think that was probably, if not totally intentional, at least partially, because I do think at the end of the movie, we're supposed to really take away the idea that Mark is now the establishment. And, you know, was it worth it? You know, does he regret what he did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Also just need to talk about how good the Larry Summer scene is real quick.
Okay, please go ahead.
Like, I love this movie so much, and it still floors me how hard I laugh at a handful of moments in that scene, even before they get into the meeting with Larry Summer. I think it's Tyler that says, you know, when the secretary tells them how old the building is, Tyler says, "We're sitting in chairs." Like she's like, or she says, "So don't break anything." She says, "We're sitting in chairs." It makes me laugh so hard every time. And I'm not somebody that, like, when I watch a comedy again, I get a lot of the same laughs. But I don't know, there's something about this scene top to bottom that just really gets me. And I find Douglas Urbanski is so funny. It should also be noted that he is a non-actor who is Gary Oldman's manager, which I think is great.
That is awesome news.
Yeah.
No, I think what's funny about that chairs line is the normal way to say that is we're sitting down.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just to mention the noun chairs in that sentence, it sounds so clunky but hilarious. And I think, yeah, that one kills me too. I think that's very funny.
Yeah. Certainly Armie Hammer's shining moment in this film, I think.
Possibly career.
Oh, definitely career. I mean, that's not in question. Did you see The Lone Ranger? Did you see The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
No.
Because I saw them both, and neither were the shining moment of his career, I can assure you.
It's too bad.
Yeah.
He'll figure it out.
Train scenes in The Lone Ranger were dope, though. I'll give him that. But I don't think he had a lot to do with that.
Probably not.
No.
Okay, what else do you want to talk about? All the things that are near and dear to your heart.
I don't know. It's so tricky. Like, I purposely just didn't, like, I have so many notes that I'm not looking at, just because this is the length of our Seinfeld podcast. If I'm running the show. But I found it interesting. You know, we've talked about the sort of old world, new world sort of thing, quite a bit, but it's just so well set, throughout the movie. And I mean, it's hit on so many times, but it's done in such an interesting way and in so many different ways. And even the subtlety of Eduardo caring about his father's opinion, right? You know, we've got Mark and Eduardo, right? Even just looking at them, how they dress, you know, it's implied in the movie that Mark does not come from money and Eduardo certainly does. But, you know, we've got Mark in his hoodies and his flip-flops and we've got Eduardo.
Which Zuckerman says is the only perfectly accurate part of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. You know, I apparently, actually, with the exception of one shirt that Jesse Eisenberg wears at one point, everything that Mark wears in this movie is something that Mark Zuckerberg has been photographed wearing.
Yeah, it's not just the style. It's right down to the individual garments. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely. And Eduardo is in suits for almost the entirety of the movie. I think it's pretty much just that party. And when he gets woken up out of bed where he's not wearing a suit, although that would have been really funny if he was wearing a suit in that bed scene. But, you know, and there's just such a difference between them, even though they're friends. Like, there's just this visual difference. And also the fact that, you know, we never hear anything about Mark's family or anything like that. Or anything older than him, you know, he just never is talking about these things. Whereas Eduardo is dressed like a person older than he is, you know, he's a 21 year old, and he's wearing a suit every goddamn day, you know? Yeah. And, he's talking about his father and what his father's going to think of him. And he cares about his father's opinion. And, even Mark is aware of that and even mentions at one point in one of his moments of humanity where, when Eduardo's name is on the masthead, when they launch the site, Eduardo says, "You have no idea what that's going to mean." My father, Mark says, "Yeah, I do." Like he understands this caring about things that came before him. Mark just doesn't have that. And as such, he doesn't listen to anybody that sort of represents the old world to him. The only person he listens to, you know, pretty much at any point of the building of Facebook is Sean, who is very, very representative of this new world that he wants to join. I mean, what's more, you know, in that same realm as Facebook, like what's a bigger sensation than Napster? You know, it's something that, was internet based and really sort of was a sensation. You know, it was absolutely a sensation. It killed the record industry. It killed the record industry at its highest point. And it's interesting that really appeals to Mark, because that's not only is it a very new sort of thing that he's following along with, the opinion wise, but it's also a very sort of fuck you style of thing where they killed the music industry.
Yeah, and taking out the dinosaur labels and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, and I think part of that is at least the way that Sean Parker is able to spin it is that he kind of went out, you know, middle fingers up. It's not like he made a whole lot of money. Like, it's not like he's, you know, as Eduardo would probably term it, successfully monetized Napster and, you know, turned it into the most profitable machine that it could have been. But he kind of, you know, was not welcome anymore. And, you know, by these people that cool people wouldn't want to be welcomed by anyway. And that's part of, I think, what it makes Sean Parker's character appealing to Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Well, and I had a question about that is because it doesn't seem like Zuckerberg wants to emulate Sean Parker. You know what I mean? He certainly thinks he's very cool, and he certainly idolizes him in a way and really values his opinion and, you know, lets him into the company, seemingly valuing him more than Eduardo, despite what Eduardo did to get this whole thing going. Mm-hmm. We don't see Mark really – I mean, Mark wants money, it seems, but he doesn't want to dress like Sean Parker or be that center of attention who all the waitresses and servers know at the really, you know, expensive bars and ordering all these drinks and paying for everybody and then taking him out to a nightclub and doing a bunch of blow and getting champagne and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. We never see the part of Mark that cares about that kind of thing. So I guess I just wanted you to kind of give me your take on why he cares so much about Sean Parker.
I don't know that he necessarily cares so much about him. It's just that he knows he needs somebody that understands the more the parts of this business that are not programming, right? That are not sort of the things that he can do from the office. It's setting up meetings and stuff like that. That's the stuff that Mark is not particularly well attuned to because he's not a people person.
But isn't that what Eduardo's for?
It is, but Eduardo is not there. Eduardo's not present where Mark thinks he knows where he needs to be. And when he does have a thought about that, it trumps whatever Eduardo's thinking, because again, Eduardo wears suits.
with collars.
Yeah, exactly. And so Mark really thinks that he should be in, he should maintain this cool aspect. And when looking at those two people, you know, Sean and Eduardo, Sean better represents the cool, you know? And I think that's why he listens to him at those points and trusts him with these things, just because he feels like Eduardo is going to do what his dad would want him to do, which would probably be safe, but might not necessarily be the best option for what Mark wants to accomplish. Whereas yeah, okay. Sean is a bombastic sort of guy. He's the guy that will go out to this club and just do shots of tequila with Victoria's Secret models and stuff, you know.
He's the guy for sure.
Yeah, he's Justin Timberlake, you know?
Yeah. So, part owner of MySpace, Justin Timberlake.
social media magnate.
Yeah. So what amount of blame do you put on Eduardo for any of this then? Kind of his missing out, kind of missing the boat on Facebook.
I mean, he's... I think it's just sort of... Like, the way that the movie sort of presents it, Eduardo doesn't offer a ton of great ideas. You know, he's certainly the money man, and his role in this movie is very important for sure.
Algorithm.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, true. And getting things off the ground. I think like the big mistake he his big mistake is not listening to Mark is pretty much it. But you know, by listening to Mark, he might have turned into somebody like Mark. And I think that's part of the lesson of the movie. Eduardo gets screwed out of, this being this unfathomably rich person. But he also gets to be the one person in a suit in this movie that's not a piece of shit, you know?
Yeah.
And the one person that is a part of any sort of establishment, old world or new, that isn't terrible, you know? And so yeah, I think it's a nice, you know, other side of the coin to Mark, in that, you know, Eduardo is the only good person in the suit, but he doesn't have the killer instinct necessary to become sort of like successful in the way that other suits would, you know? Whereas Mark has that instinct, but not the suit. And, you know, sort of starts to find himself in this world and starts to maybe kind of regret certain things that he's done. Whereas Eduardo certainly regrets many things, specifically not getting lawyers to look over his contracts. But he still at least has humanity, you know, certainly more humanity than Mark. So it's sort of like they both have regrets, just totally different kinds.
Right. Yeah. Do you like Andrew Garfield in this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Am I not supposed to?
No, you can do whatever you want.
Okay, I just thought I think this is a really well-acted movie, pretty much top to bottom.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that these aren't... I mean, who had Fincher worked with of these people before?
I don't think anybody.
Nobody, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think anybody.
Like, he was friends with Douglas Urbanski, and that's how he has the role.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's cool that, I mean... This is a young new cast that he hasn't worked with, and all talented actors who have, you know, gone on to successful careers. Just pretend Army Hammer doesn't exist. Yeah, exactly. And I just think it's so perfect for this movie about young people coming up and changing everything. It's these new faces. I mean, people know Rooney Mara now. People know Jesse Eisenberg now. People know Andrew Garfield now. Mm-hmm. But they'd all acted before and things like that, but just really got elevated. I think it's interesting just with this movie that it kind of did the similar thing for their careers.
Yeah, exactly. And also when you look at parts of Fincher's career, like he loves playing with expectations of his lead, like the baggage you're bringing in for his lead, like Ben Affleck and Gone Girl. I think the most prominent example is Michael Douglas in The Game. Like, you're just supposed to assume he's Gordon Gekko in that movie. And he loves playing with these things. And I think it's really interesting that in this movie, just because of the age of the characters and as such, the age of the people that he had to cast, he doesn't have that to play with. And I think that elevates the movie to an extent, because anytime there's somebody really recognizable in a movie, they bring a certain element of baggage to it. I think Justin Timberlake's presence in this movie is very representative of that, because we can't see Justin Timberlake and not be like, that's Justin Timberlake, you know? Like, everybody thinks of him as a musician first. As such, the only, I think, pretty much non-perfect performance in this movie is Justin Timberlake. But you know, Fincher not having that to play with, I think, is helpful. And I think something that's really funny to me now is that, as you were saying, these people aren't really established. Like, you and I both know knew who Jesse Eisenberg was in 2010 for this movie. We probably both saw The Squid and the Whale, and Zombieland was the year before this movie. And Adventureland, of course. A lot of land movies. Anyway.
Yeah. I've noticed that, too.
Okay. But yeah, I certainly appreciated Jesse Eisenberg before this. But other than that, I didn't know anybody, really. But now you look at Batman versus Superman. Jesse Eisenberg is cast as Lex Luthor because of his role as Mark Zuckerberg, because they want to play with that baggage. And I think it's really cool that Mark becomes the old world and brings Jesse along with him, you know? And now, like... Even though Jesse wants to deny the fact that he's a movie star and everything, you know, he's still got Now You See Me and Now Two See Me and Batman versus Superman, you know. He's sort of giving in at points.
Yeah. That's okay though. The more Jesse Eisenberg, the better for me.
Yeah, he's good in everything. Have you ever seen him not be good in something?
That interview with Romina.
Oh, please, that's the finest performance of his career.
I don't think he's performing at all.
Yeah, I know. He's so good.
Yeah. I mean, I was asking about Andrew Garfield just because I didn't know he has to be emotional in this movie, mm-hmm. because so few people are a lot of the time, mm-hmm. Or at least Mark Zuckerberg's such a central part of this movie and he's fairly cold. I didn't know if you thought it was kind of a bit too much of a over the top, kind of hard on the sleeve performance, or if that's just kind of, that works well for Eduardo's character.
I think it works well for Eduardo's character, and I think Andrew Garfield is particularly adept at pulling that off. I think there's just some sort of element of naturalism to me that I think exists with him that is, I think, you know, just sort of innate in a lot of really, really talented performers. And I think he's perfect for Eduardo because, I mean, he looks likable, you know, like he just looks like somebody that would never harm anybody. And just sort of the way he smiles and the way he dances over to Mark in that that party. There's just something just inherently likable about him, you know? And if you're supposed to like anybody in this movie, it's Eduardo, you know?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Or Sean Parker. He's friends with Chamillionaire. I've kind of got some closing stuff. Is there anything else you wanted to... make sure we got to?
Well, we should talk about Aaron Sorkin, I think.
Okay.
Because I think we should talk about it. We should also talk about the Steve Jobs movie a little bit, even though, unless you've seen it in the meantime, I know you haven't seen it. Okay, so I think the reason that this movie, because I think this is the best thing David Fincher's ever done, and this is coming from David Fincher superfan number 99. And I also think this is definitely the best thing Aaron Sorkin has done, and I think by a wider margin than Fincher. I think what's really fascinating about this movie and why they were able to each reach their highest highs together is because they're both of a certain stature, right? Aaron Sorkin is if you can get an Aaron Sorkin script, that's amazing. You know, it's Aaron Sorkin. And he's a screenwriter who... who people like just know his name, you know?
Yeah, which is rare.
Which is very uncommon, especially for somebody that doesn't direct their own movies, you know? Like Quentin Tarantino is a notable screenwriter, but he's,
yeah,
he's a director.
Yeah, it helps his individual persona so much because he also gets to decide how things go visually and all the other things directors choose.
Exactly. And David Fincher is a superstar auteur. I mean, Gone Girl, I mean, I know it's 4 years after The Social Network, and part of the reason they were selling it this way is because of The Social Network. But, you know, David Fincher is a superstar auteur. His name is a selling point. You know, it's a name people know because he's so talented and also successful. Like, his movies actually make money for the most part. And so when they get together and start to work together, they each have a reputation that's good enough that they have to listen to each other's thoughts, you know? And I think this is really, really telling in each of the projects that they work on immediately following The Social Network, because The Social Network, huge critical success, financial success as well, and to the point where they each got to do exactly what they wanted next. And what Aaron Sorkin did was The Newsroom, and what David Fincher did was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is the most Fincherian movie that he will ever make, and because of that, it's so cold and so like over the top fuck you sort of thing. Like, it has faults there for it, some big faults. And Aaron Sorkin, you watch The Newsroom and you see all that rom-com stuff that comes back in, and all the angry yelling white man stuff that comes back in, and it you know, hurts that show. I didn't watch all of it, but I watched enough of it to sort of see that, you know, Sorkin was back in control, right?
Yeah.
And so what I think probably happened from David Fincher agreeing to shoot this movie and Aaron Sorkin, you know, write the final shooting script, is I can almost guarantee you Erica's role is cut down. And also I think, Fincher's, more fuck you, leanings were cut down as well. Because Sorkin is sort of more humanistic than, David Fincher, and David Fincher is more, Mark Zuckerbergian than Aaron Sorkin, you know? I think typically the problem I have with Aaron Sorkin movies is that they're too emotional, and or, you know, he tries to hit these emotional strings too hard and fails. And David Fincher sometimes tries to hit the fuck you button too hard and fails, you know. And they work together really closely all throughout the movie. Aaron Sorkin was on set, I believe, for at least the majority of the picture. He actually directed the last shot of principal photography. David Fincher left the set, straight up left the set and said, you know, you're shooting this final shot. And Aaron Sorkin got to call it's a wrap on The Social Network, which is funny to me. But, you know, they work together really closely. Aaron Sorkin says the reason that he's on set is because a screenplay is written to be performed, and he wants to make sure people get the intonations right and all that stuff. They also had three weeks of rehearsal leading into the movie. And if you watch the special features on the Blu-ray, you can see that they have really interesting conversations about how they should change the script. And I think just because each of them had a certain stature, a comparable stature, neither of them could bulldoze over the other. And I think that's the biggest thing that really helps this movie, is aside from each of these key creative talents, they had to listen to the other key creative talents, you know?
Yeah, and that balance kind of reins in some of their tendencies to overdo a lot of their strengths, but just that little bit too much is brought in, right?
Yeah, exactly. And just to quickly talk about the things that I didn't like about the Steve Jobs movie. It's a fine movie, but like, you can tell Danny Boyle just doesn't have the backbone or the talent to stand up to Aaron Sorkin or to really make a movie his own. And you see a lot of Steadicam walk and talks, which is the Aaron Sorkin staple, which there are not a lot of in The Social Network.
No.
And the ending of Steve Jobs movie is so bad, and like in a type of way that David Fincher would never ever allow. And I joked after I saw the movie, they should have paid David Fincher $15 million to straighten that movie out, because he demanded $10 million and the Sony hacks. It was sort of a thing that they wouldn't pay it. But yeah, you can really sort of see that type of thing. And it's just these two really talented people that have to listen to each other. And notably working in concert in a movie that is all about two people working close together and then not being together at the end of it.
Yeah.
So I've always found that really interesting about this movie.
Yeah.
And that sometimes you need somebody else to actually help you do your best work, you know? So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know. Should we talk about I think we need to talk about the asshole lines, right?
We did a little bit. What do you mean?
Well, just because, you know, there's two mentions of Mark specifically being an asshole in the movie, or not being an asshole in the second one. You know, we talked about it will be because you're an asshole, right? And
yeah, well, and that's what I want to kind of ask you about kind of in closing was that speech Marilyn gives at the end, or that at least discussion they kind of have about how she's specialized in selecting juries.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I just wanted to get kind of your idea on what the significance of that is. Like, because the point of her, well, I'm not going to say the point, but I mean, what she's talking about in her little discussion there is that they'll be able to, she'd be able to present Mark as a bad guy just by kind of presenting some of the stories that have been shared and not with hard and fast evidence say he was the one who reported the chicken story to the school newspaper or he's the one who called the cops on Sean, but it's enough to kind of float that idea out there. Is that what she's getting at in that, or is there something else a bit deeper that kind of contained in that?
I think it's just that perception matters, I think, is the big part of that. And in the way that conversation is shot, you know, they're both framed in wide angle shots, and then we push in a little bit on each, and they're both in mid shots as they're talking, and they're very much equals. And then Marilyn starts discussing the jury selection sort of thing and explaining to Mark, and then we stay on the mid shot of Rashida Jones and go back to the wide shot of Jesse. So now he's smaller in the frame because Marilyn Delpy is explaining things to him. And he's just sort of part of one of the things that he doesn't always understand in the movie is sort of perception, right? And how his actions can be seen. And very, very frequently he doesn't care about these things, and it's what helps him get ahead. Like, part of Cameron Winklevoss's problem is that he cared about how these things would be seen. Like, he specifically says, you know, we have to care about how these things look from the outside. Yeah. Mark very much does not care about that. And I think one of the big things that Mark is supposed to learn throughout this movie is that is impulse control, you know, because this whole the whole story starts because Mark couldn't control his impulses, right? And I think that's something that's very key to a lot of modern technology, is that he had the tools in front of him to go home, be
call
angry.
Her a bitch,
yeah, exactly,
on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. And he had the tools to go home and immediately start blogging about his feelings, and since he could do it immediately, he didn't have to think about what he did before he started doing it. And, you know, maybe he's got some regrets about how he did it now, but, you know, he posted his thoughts immediately because he had the opportunity to, you know, and
sucked on that.
yeah, exactly. And throughout the whole movie, we see him thinking, or sorry, pretty much saying immediately what he thinks, you know, the clip of these movies that this movie moves at as part of it. But he never really thinks about this meaning until we get to the very end, and we see him holding in the last sort of flashback, we see him holding his "I'm CEO, bitch," right? And the business card. And that's sort of like he's holding a relic of his own past. You know, he's holding a relic of the person he was at Harvard, but now he's in California and he's got to deal with these things. He has to care about how Sean Parker's arrest looks because it will hurt the company. And he just looks at it and it's like, that's not something he would say anymore. "I'm CEO, bitch" is not something he would say anymore. And I think this movie is actually kind of hopeful for Mark Zuckerberg. I think despite portraying him as an asshole throughout the movie, I think it kind of ends on a really humanistic note that it seems like really only identifies with people that are also assholes as humanists, you know, like Fincher says it, Aaron Sorkin says it, and now I'm saying it. Not to say that I'm anywhere near them, but in any sort of capacity other than being an asshole. But I think it just sort of ends kind of hopefully because he starts to think about these things and he thanks Marilyn for her work at the end. And I think it's the first time he thanks anybody in the movie. And he now sort of understands how he should treat people because he understands that the way he has treated people has led to a lot of problems, you know?
Yeah. No, so. I think him kind of him holding that business card, it's like, I ordered these, you know, whatever, a few weeks ago. And, you know, I thought that was cool then, but now the time has passed and my decisions have now shown up kind of on my desk and I just look like an asshole.
Yeah, exactly. And that is also when we've got the last usage of Hand Covers Bruise, the title theme, and it just, it's like an echo of who he used to be, you know? And it's beautiful.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, it's because he does look like an asshole for so much of it. And we certainly don't get an overly sweet moment where it all gets wrapped up nicely. But I do think that there is that idea that he is seeing mistakes and he is regretting things. And that's why, you know, we start with him, you know, losing Erica because he has other things on his mind. And now we get that, you know, the book ended at the bottom of the film with him wanting Erica back. And I don't think it's so much about him wanting that specific person back, but kind of having looked at all these decisions, where it's got him, what different approaches you can take to different things, and just kind of wanting back human connection and something more than, you know, being CEO bitch.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that I promise I'll make this brief, but it really ties into Fincher's career arc as a whole, because I think one of the things that's always present in his movies is the way that he looks at the establishment and money in general. But, you know, like you look at Seven, right? The cops don't catch the killer. The killer turns himself in. With The Game, we've got the whole movie is about taking down a Gordon Gekko type character played by the guy that played Gordon Gekko. Yes. Fight Club, I mean, I don't even need to explain it. I suppose I will. They blow up the credit card companies. You know, they blow up parts of the establishment. Panic Room happens because Jodie Foster buys a house bigger than what she needs. The whole movie is just about not living above your needs. And Zodiac is about a cartoonist solving a mystery that nobody else could. Like, the cops couldn't solve it. And if you look at Benjamin Button, the only character in that movie that is rich is Benji Boo's absentee father. And, you know, and that leads into The Social Network, where we kind of get this really interesting turn of watching a character sort of become that character that Fincher would take down in a later movie, you know? We see him becoming Michael Douglas at the beginning of The Game, you know, as opposed to you know, the way his movies go. And so when we get that last scene with Rashida Jones saying, "You're not an asshole, you're just trying so hard to be," what that is that she is somebody that has actually seen all of the evidence on Mark. Like, she's seen it all. She's probably done a lot of the research involved in each deposition. She can see those small slivers of humanity because she has been looking at Mark just as with, you know, just as big of a magnifying glass as any of the other lawyers. So she's able to see those moments where he's not a terrible person, where he says he knows what it would mean to Eduardo's father, you know, to have his name on the masthead. And I think that that's a really nice moment. And as she leaves, you know, and he can stay and use the computer, whatever her last line is. And we see Mark sitting at a computer. The sound drops out again for the first time since Erica talked about him being an asshole at the beginning. And it does briefly drop out in between the club scene and the regatta scene, but I think that's more style than meaning. But Yeah, the sound drops out, and all we can hear, like, the sound design in that scene is so good. We can hear the hum of the computer. We can hear Mark Zuckerberg typing a little bit as he goes on to Erica's Facebook page. And he's finally left alone in a quiet room with his own thoughts for the first time since the opening. Like, he's finally considering, like, at the beginning when we get quiet, he's considering what he's going to do as a result of being called an asshole. And now we see him considering what it cost, right? Like, why he's finally sitting alone thinking to himself, why did I do this, you know? And then the music cue starts, and the first thing it says, the first line of the song is, how does it feel to be one of the beautiful people? Yeah. You know? And it's, and we also get this return to the rock music from the beginning of the movie. It's the Beatles. It's one of the most iconic rock bands of all time, you know, and this very sort of classical, old-fashioned music, because it set the tone for all of the rock music to follow. Yeah. And it's just, he knows that he's an asshole now, but he might not be, but he's definitely part of the establishment. He's wondering, why did he do it? And he's just sitting alone with his own thoughts and wondering, how does it feel to be one of the beautiful people? And that's the end of the movie. And it's just sort of like, you did it. You did everything you wanted. Maybe you should have done less, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful movie with a beautiful ending, and everything about it is perfect. David Fincher for president.
2016.
Actually, no, because then you wouldn't be able to make movies.
Fincher Sorkin 2016.
I could deal with that.
Okay.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back for our next episode.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.